Okay, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Brett Riley. I'm from Affinity Consulting, and I'm going to chair our next session on emerging risks, specifically from climate change. The world of risk management, as we all know, we're all risk managers, is many and varied. On the way here, we nearly had an incident. We got lost. Tim and I came to the registration desk and said, oh, we're here. We're to talk at the third plenary session. We didn't recognise anyone. They said, you're not Michael, you're not John, no, it's Tim and Brett. We didn't realise that had moved upstairs, so we went to where the GI session was yesterday. But a minor risk compared to what we're going to talk about today. Just the usual admin announcements. Please remember to fill in your presenter feedback forms via the ERM Connect device. For those who prefer old school, there's the hard copy forms at the registration desk. And the mobile phone routine, you should already know. Please leave them on, but switch them to silent. The phone number will come up. It's the same number that you've seen before. SMS your text messages through, but we will take questions from the floor as well. And if you're a tweeter, or as David Cameron, I think, described them, a twat, maybe not. If you are into tweeting, please feel free to use the hashtag 2014ERMTweet. So, our topic is emerging risk from climate change. What is an emerging risk? Lloyd's define it as an issue which is perceived to be potentially significant, but which may not be fully understood or allowed for. And from a Lloyd's perspective, they're describing it in terms of in insurance, terms and conditions, pricing, reserving, or capital setting. I've heard people from Swiss Re describe it as an unrealised risk compared to realised risks, which we're all familiar with. Climate change is perhaps the greatest or one of the ultimate emerging risks given the timeframes involved. It's a risk facing many companies, not just those in general insurance, as it affects strategy. The theme of the seminar is capturing the upside, and I think we'll hear about some opportunities maybe where companies can look for opportunities coming from this emerging trend. Those who attended the GI seminar on Monday and Tuesday would have heard an excellent plenary discussion of climate change, catastrophes and the challenges facing general insurers, governments and communities. So for those who didn't attend, I'd encourage you to go to the Institute website and have a look at those presentations as well. But not steal the thunder from our speakers. We've got three equally impressive views on climate risk today. Our first speaker is Professor Barbara Norman, whose background is in planning. Barbara will address the scientific findings and implications for the industry. Emma Heard from Westpac will then provide a banking perspective, including developing resilience within an organisation, as well as considering product and commercial opportunities arising from this risk. And finally, Tim Andrews will round off the plenary, drawing on his GI and reinsurance experience, including current and future implications for these industries. But I'll introduce our first speaker. Professor Barbara Norman is the Foundation Chair of Urban and Regional Planning in the Faculty of Business, Government and Law at the University of Canberra. Professor Norman is Director of Canberra Urban and Regional Futures, or CURF. Do you use that abbreviation, CURF? Yeah. And an adjunct professor with the ANU, Chair of the ACT Climate Change Council and Deputy Chair of Regional Development Australia for the ACT. Barbara is a Life Fellow and past President of the Planning Institute of Australia and Life Honorary Fellow of the Royal Town Planning Institute in the UK. The research institutes include urban and regional planning, sustainable coastal planning, climate change, adaptation, and urban guidance. Sorry?
We can finish there.
And she was awarded an Australian Centenary Medal for her contributions to the community through urban and regional planning. Well-credentialed, please welcome Professor Norman.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Brett, and thank you for inviting a planner to your audience. Didn't really understand most of the standards that went up before, but we have a fair share in my profession. But what it really raised with me is we need to talk a lot more between the planners who are making decisions about infrastructure and land use and the actuaries who are providing excellent advice to the financial institutions. And that brings me to climate change, because doing all of that in the context of climate change is really the discussion for this morning, from my perspective. So, to my presentation, a risk management approach, and what I think we are discussing here is risk. Whether it's you discussing risk, the IPCC latest report discussing risk and that was a very significant change from their former reports. This report, IPCC fifth report, framed it around risk for the first time. And so that's where I see these connections only increasing. So I'm sure much of the information around climate change is you would be aware of, but let me just put it simply, the globe is getting warmer. And in Australia, hotter and drier. And that has many implications for the decisions that we make. From the IPCC fifth report, which I was a contributing author to, very significant implications for our cities and coastal development, major challenges in implementing adaptation measures, how we adapt to these changes, and perhaps on a more controversial note, as the science is getting stronger, our policy response in this country seems to be becoming weaker. And importantly, from your perspective, we have no adaptation strategy at all in Australia. So it's something to be discussing maybe later on. The IPCC fifth report highlighted the impact of floods, fire and heat on communities. And many of you, I suspect, could say we have experienced this always in Australia, in our life, over many generations. And I've seen some of that commentary in the press from some of our leaders. However, it's really the dimension of change, the quantum of change that we're interested in. And that's where I see scenario planning, and you've been discussing scenario planning from an actuary's perspective, that's where planning is starting to look, because no longer can we rely on the historical records to be able to plan for risk in terms of where we plan our future major urban developments in this country, where we locate those, and how we can minimise risk to those future communities. So it is actually no longer business as usual. There are also limits to adaptation. That's a very important concept to share this morning. The Great Barrier Reef can only adapt to so many rapid rises in sea level, sea surface temperatures. The human body, taking the health discussion earlier, can only respond to a certain amount of heat temperature increase. And as many of you would know, in the Victorian bushfires, more people died from heat-related stress than they did from the actual fire. So health and heat and risk are real implications for the future. I mentioned major implications for new development, redevelopment and infrastructure. Often we hear these discussions, particularly in the coastal environment, we hear discussions around housing. But if you think about what the uses are around the coast, major critical national infrastructure lies on our coastline. And yes, it may not be on the front page of the press, but trust me, Emergency Management Australia and like organisations at the national level are doing very detailed work around how we will protect those national critical infrastructure facilities in the future. Because this has implications for how we work as a nation, our productivity, and how we are able to respond in emergencies. So we're dealing with very significant change. What about our planning system, which is my background? I was National President of the Planning Institute, have worked in most jurisdictions. The implications there are very real. And the issue with the planning system is it's been fantastic for many, many, many years, and we inherited it from the British, and it's held us in good stead for a long time. But it's actually based on the premise that we're dealing with a static environment. But in fact, what we're now dealing with is now and in the future is a very dynamic environment. So what happens when the land falls into the sea? We didn't factor that in when we designed our planning system, and I'd love to have a discussion with you when we have the panel as to whether you've factored that into your assumptions into the future. And I can assure you the legal profession certainly hasn't. So that's something to think about. So very significant challenges in terms of infrastructure and the basis upon which we're making decisions, including your, may I suggest, your profession. So we need an adaptation strategy for Australia, and it may also mean that we're shifting not only incrementally, not more of the same, again and again and again, but we'll go through what we call the tipping points from the scientific literature to transformational change. We may not approve development in high-risk areas in the future, full stop, because the consequences, the cost to the community, all of you, because all of you pay in the end, as a community, I'm not just talking to you as actuaries, all of you as a community, What happens after a big fire? The Prime Minister, we've had this from both sides, not a political statement, flies in after the fire or the flood and said everyone can rebuild exactly where they were before. And it's very understandable why that happens. It's a very emotional time, sense of belonging, sense of community. But can we realistically continue down that path? That's not just a question for actuaries, it's a question for banks and the financial institutions. What are they going to be lending for in the future? We are not actually coping with extreme events already. And if you speak with the communities that have been through these, they don't need convincing about this. So the emphasis should be on adaptation, but also must remain, the primary emphasis must remain on mitigation, about how we reduce the emissions in the future. Climate change has been a very political discussion in this country. I think the weekend, though, I think may have seen some signs of moving forward. In the last, three or four weeks, major statements from the head of United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, head of the European Commission, head of China, head of the United States, I could go on. 39 countries now have carbon pricing policies. So you could see that this is starting to change quite quickly. And I think that whether we like it or not, as a nation in Australia, we'll be dragged kicking and screaming into this new world. And so I think you, as actuaries, I hope you're starting to think about these issues. So the IPCC, coming back to the actual report, risk management approach, this is the framework that they've placed for discussion, vulnerability, exposure, hazards, and the culmination of that defining risk. But also looking at both natural variability, recognising that the weather does change every day, hot and cold, and things happen, and we do have droughts. And so this is not new, but it's the additional factor of human-induced climate change that concerns us. And that there are a number of consequences and pathways about going forward. So in many ways, internationally, and certainly the international meetings I'm involved in, the science is largely settled, and the focus is now switching to public policy responses and socio-economic consequences of these risks. Most of my work is around coastal planning, fire and climate change. And I'll just very quickly bring it from the kind of global national perspective to down to a very local perspective, and I don't expect you to read all of that, but you will get a copy of this presentation. Give you a very, in this last few minutes, very couple of quick examples of homegrown research from the ground up. So there's global messages coming, but there's also messages coming from the community. The Southeast Coastal Adaptation work involves seven local councils from Wollongong to Lakes Entrance in Gippsland, involved three universities, Australian National University, University of Canberra and University of Wollongong, and regional organisations. It just won the National Planning Award in Australia for cutting-edge research for this year. And the reason it did was this collaboration working across disciplines, working with local government and regional organisations from the ground up to try and work out what are the risks and what would a climate-adapted community look like in 2030. And this is where I see a strong connection with your discussion around scenarios and our work emerging in scenario planning. And actually, I think there could be some fantastic conversations and future opportunities, as you say, between our professions in the future. But very much, again, the risk is coming through. If you see Principle 3, risk management approaches, a precautionary approach to be thinking about, should we place that urban development right on the edge of the coastal domain at this point? Now, you might say that health is not far from politics, but planning is never far from politics. And I can just refer to the other ICAC, the Independent Commission Against Corruption in New South Wales, to give you some evidence there. The other one's around fire, which has just been published, 3 years of research with the Bushfire CRC. Again, really saying that issues around governance, risk and management are core to how we address these issues in the future. And implications, again, the science is there, the numbers can be done by the Actuary Institute, the broad facts and figures. But if the governance and decision-making process is not working or the worst scenario corrupt, then really all the cards fall down. and we don't respond properly. So I guess the key message is we have to be working right across the board with this issue, and also climate change, the response to climate change needs to be mainstream right across government decision making. One of the reasons we won the National Award for the Coastal Work was we started to experiment with new ways of communication. Now, you might regard this as a bit kind of on the edge and a bit funky and a bit far away from what the work that you do. But trust me, communicating with artists when you're at the local community level, and this was in the township of Eden, can be very effective engaging high school students, primary school students, and the broader community about understanding these issues. And central banks may not be so switched into this, but the local branch will be. The local branch in Eden will be. They'll be in the community discussing these issues. They're doing their job properly, and they'll be starting to get some feedback around some of the risks. So I don't dismiss that very local issue, very local way of communicating, and start to explore some of these new methods, not just scenario planning, but how we better communicate what the implications are. I have already mentioned accountability, and this is a quote from ICAC. And in terms of my profession, a lot of people see planning as that statutory regulatory environment. Often you haven't had a happy experience. You've tried to put an extension on your house and run into the planning system, or your local park has come under threat and you've been protesting against the planning system. And it's just not working, is it? One of the strong messages I'm giving back to my profession now, and I totally agree with ICAC here, is we need to get on the front foot in the context of climate change, working with people like yourself on strategic planning. Strategic planning about where our capital cities will be growing in the future, how we are going to incorporate the millions of new people we need to house between now and 2050, not just in capital cities, but in regional Australia. So be on the front foot and start to minimise risks through better planning in the future and move away a little bit from the focus on the regulatory and the compliance. Planetary boundaries. And you're wondering, oh, Barbara's gone from the very local now to the global. What's this all about? In coming to this talk, I read a report that was produced by, and I'll just flick forward and then I'll come back, by your Kindred Institute in the UK. And trust me, this is a new field to me, so I might have this all wrong. But really, they were really arguing this report, and I really encourage you to read it. You may all be on top of this already. But really, it has some implications about how we address climate change too. We don't live in a resource-free, unlimited world. Now, as we grow as a population, a global population, we will face these stresses. And really what this message was saying back to your Kindred organisation in the UK is you need to start factoring this in. You will actually run out of some resources. And so we have what we call this concept coming through the scientists, leading global scientists now being published in Nature around planetary boundaries. Living within planetary boundaries will be our challenge, and a challenge to you, I guess, is to review the assumptions behind your work in how we do that, how we plan for that, and how we live in a carbon-constrained, a resource-constrained global future. Just coming to conclusions, right on time. Thank you, Brett. Climate change is here and now. One of the lessons that has been learnt, I think, by the climate scientists and I'm not a scientist, I'm a planner, I'm the person who thinks about the public policy implications for how we design our cities and regions in the future and where we locate infrastructure in the future. Climate change is here and now. And in the previous discussion, we kept talking about 2050 and 2100. And everybody's eyes would glaze over and go, well, it's got nothing to do with me, I'll be dead and gone, what's it matter? Well, it is here and now, and even if it is 2050, your children will be here and your grandchildren will be here. And so it's a very real factor. Having said that, what I said before is we don't cope with the extreme weather events we have now, so let alone what we may be facing in the future. So it's not something we can dismiss in any way. There seems to be almost a convergence of approaches around risk management, and that goes straight into your space. So I see that as an enormous opportunity for this industry. We're not living in an unconstrained environment, which is a point that I just made, so we need to start thinking about those factors. We do need to be incorporating climate change, and I'm certainly looking at reviewing the whole national planning system to ensure that we are considering climate change. So whether you're considering it or not, we'll start to see it very much coming into the regulatory environment. And then finally, maybe a point that I didn't emphasise enough through this process, our consumers need to have full information and be informed about these risks. I guess an example would be mapping areas subject to flood risk. It's not very helpful to those consumers out there if you're doing your own modelling work, government's doing their own modelling work, everyone's a bit nervous about releasing it. People out there have a right to know, in my view, and then we could start to have a much better discussion. The Productivity Commission came out on a report, had a very significant report a couple of years ago on climate change adaptation. One of the key points, well, one was market failure. How are we going back in terms of barriers? How do we deal with market failure? The second was about this sort of full information and people having an ability to understand the risks themselves and be able to take action themselves in adapting to change. So this course is autonomous adaptation, it's described as. So I think that's a really important point, that we need a credible system with integrity behind all of this. Thank you for listening and look forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Barbara. Our second speaker is Emma Hurd. Emma is an Executive Director of Emissions and Environment at Westpac. So I guess we've heard the local view, and I think we're going to hear what's being done at the corporate level now. Working across all areas of Westpac, Emma is responsible for leading the bank's strategic response to climate change and for driving commercial solutions for emerging environmental challenges and opportunities. Emma is also a director of the Carbon Market Institute Board and a member of the Cornerstone Capital Group Advisory Council. Please welcome Emma.
Thanks very much. So in my 10 minutes, I'm going to try and take the whole complex big picture world of climate change science and try and translate it into the very specific strategic response of a corporate, of an Australian financial institution. I'm also happy to say that my slides, without any deliberate intent, actually reinforce all of the points that Barbara just made. So it's actually nice to hear that we're heading in the right direction. I guess what I really want to do is just very quickly start by saying that what we see is that business is recognising climate change and environmental issues such as resource constraints as an emerging risk. And I say emerging even though it's been emerging for 30 years and it will continue to emerge for at least another 100, 150, 200 years depending on our response. But there's no doubt that it's an emerging risk because our understanding and our response and our view of where it sits in the whole lexicon of risks that corporates face is also emerging in that sense. This is quite hard to read, but really all I wanted to do is point you towards a report that comes out on an annual basis at the World Economic Forum in Davos, not exactly renowned as being a bunch of hippies, but this is a report which surveys around 700 business leaders, CEOs, civil society leaders, which asks them to identify what are the long-term, complex, difficult, emerging and systemic risks impacting their business and their operating environment. And it's color-coded, so blue is economic, green is environment, purple is technological, orange is geopolitical, and red is societal. And it's, interestingly enough, it also identifies trust in the internet and increasing digitalization as an emerging risk, just going back to the stress testing session that we had previously. But the reason I point this out is because what it shows is emerging recognition of environmental risks as key systemic risks for your business and your operating environment. This starts in 2007 at the height of the GFC, and I don't think it's any surprise to show that a business was identifying economic risks as the key and the most significant risk impacting their business. It also showed that the societal and the geopolitical implications of economic dysfunction were a major factor. But what it also shows is that over the last, say, 4 or 5 years, the dominance of environmental risks has begun to show through. And this is not just climate change as an all-encompassing risk. It's actually a more disaggregated and sophisticated understanding of different aspects of climate risk. So it includes failure to respond to climate change, just as it includes regulatory impacts of the response to climate change. So I think the point that I'm making here is that business is getting better at disaggregating the all-encompassing issue of climate risk and understanding what it means for them, for their business this year, as well as in the emerging operational environment. So how does a company respond to these issues? How do you actually get your hands around something as complex and long-term as an issue of such as climate change? I think the first thing you have to do, like any major issue, is you have to translate it into commercial strategy. You have to have a position and a view, which is agreed across the organisation at an extremely senior level, at the board level. Then you have to translate that strategy into commercial opportunity. Then you have to be prepared to disclose your response. So I'm just going to step through those three sort of major points in terms of what Westpac's doing. And conveniently, I can also talk about it in the context of our new climate change strategy, which we launched last week. So I think it's you know, Westpac's had a strong position on climate change for a number of years now. We've actually been reporting on our emissions since 1996. We're a founding signatory globally to a number of industry-wide standards and organisations, such as the UN Environment Programme Finance Initiative and the Equator Principles, a risk management framework. But the reason we do this is because we continually reset and refresh our strategic approach. So our previous climate change position statement ran from 2008 to 2012-13, which is our financial year. And this year we've gone through a somewhat gruesome process of resetting the whole strategy and the whole position statement, and we just reissued it last year. This position statement will run to 2017. 2017 is the date where all Westpac's current business strategies are targeting, because that's the year when the bank turns 200 years old. So all of our commercial strategies at the moment are aimed at this question of what kind of company do we want to be when we enter our third century? And obviously, big issues like climate change are a major factor in our response as well. The actual position statement includes three parts. It's what's our view on the big issues, which is actually incredibly important to set at the executive team and the board level, because you need to know where you stand on the big issues, because I don't think I will be shocking anyone in saying that it's a somewhat volatile external environment in which to comment on these issues. So you need to set and forget in terms of what your actual view is. It also sort of looks to encompass not just climate change but environmental issues as well, because one of the impacts that we found over the last 5 years in particular is that it's impossible to look at climate risk without looking at energy security, without looking at water security, without looking at food security, without looking at population growth, urbanisation, industrialisation, the emergence of Asia. You have to have an interconnected view on these issues. Otherwise, it's not an effective response. So it's actually climate change and environment position statement. And then we have an action plan for the next 3 years. But the bit that I really want to call your attention to is the three main themes that the bank will be focusing on over the next 3 years. So the first of which is adaptation and resilience. So that's what I mean by somewhat conveniently following on from Barbara, because what we find is there is a lack of a coherent national approach in Australia to understanding resilience and adaptation issues. We are incredibly strong in particular areas, such as disaster response. But what we've increasingly found is that small business doesn't fail immediately after a significant disaster. It fails 6 months later because normal business conditions have not returned. So actually having a more longer-term view on these sorts of issues from a business perspective, from an economic perspective, is important. We're also focusing on the role of cities and small government in terms of the response, because of the incredibly urbanised nature of our society. The increasing urbanisation of society globally. That's a global theme. And then lastly, this notion of the two-degree economy, which is a phrase that we've coined to try and encapsulate a somewhat complicated concept. The two-degree economy, what we mean by that is, what does it mean economically for Australia and the world to actually limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, which is actually what every government, every country is signing up to, including Australia and New Zealand and every country where we operate. What does it mean economically to actually impose hard carbon constraints to limit warming to 2 degrees? What does it mean to adapt to global warming of 2 degrees? Because that has a cost as well. And understanding the symbiotic nature of that relationship is also important. We can't have a conversation about mitigation on one side and adaptation on the other, because that's not a complete conversation. So this is sometimes variously referred to as the gap. Talk to someone like BHP. Shell also includes a lot of these sorts of notions in scenario modelling, as we talked about earlier, in terms of actually bringing together current economic forecasts around, say, for example, export demand and actual carbon constraints. Let's have a sophisticated conversation around what this means economically. It also means commercial opportunities. I mean, any commercial organisation has to be able to translate these sorts of identified risks into a commercial response from a mitigation perspective. How do you mitigate the risks that also has the potential for some commercial opportunities? So for a bank, a bank that lends to or invests in every single industry sector across the economy at every level and every size, there are also opportunities for us in terms of facilitating the transition to a more low-carbon economy. And that means the development, the deployment, the financing of clean technology solutions. So a couple of years ago, we actually made a public commitment around making available up to $6 billion in lending and investment for clean tech and environmental services by 2017, again, 2017. Last week, we announced that we've actually hit $8 billion in half the amount of time because of the significant growth and demand in appetite across all industry sectors for clean tech and environmental services. The business is moving. They're recognising the need for commercial and strategic differentiation within industry sectors. They're looking for product and technology solutions, and they're applying them. Interestingly enough, the majority of the growth that we saw in this particular target was in the property sector, in the greening of the property sector. Both in terms of new build. New buildings almost all have high environmental standards, 5 or 6 star neighbours ratings, for example, but also significantly in retrofitting and refurbishment of existing properties as well. So around energy efficiency, greater insulation, adaptation aspects, that kind of thing. So we're actually looking at how we differentiate our reporting on that to make it more clear where that activity is happening. So in terms of opportunities, risk management for banks, for financial institutions, is also about where are the solutions going to come from? Who's providing them? Who are the new companies and new industry sectors coming through that are delivering the solutions? It's not just all don't lend to this sector or don't invest in this activity. It's actually about how well are companies managing down their risks? Where are they looking for solutions? And are we supporting the emergence of new industry sectors to deliver these solutions as well? So having a view across the whole economy is actually incredibly important in that regard. Lastly, disclosure is also really important. What we're seeing is increasing demand, investor-driven demand, for disclosure from financial institutions on embedded carbon risk. So this is at both a portfolio level. So you may have heard what's variously referred to as the carbon bubble or unburnable carbon. So what are the actual financial or hard economic impacts of capping carbon, and how well are financial institutions managing that on a portfolio basis? The other long-term industry sector is superannuation. When you're making investment decisions over 15, 20, 30 years, this is a live financial impact that you need to be managing. So increasingly, financial institutions are being asked, how well positioned are you? And this is not just about divestment, as it's somewhat simplistically referred to, get out of all emissions-intensive activities. It's actually about how balanced is your portfolio, how are you supporting the solutions, how are you responding to consumer demand, in much the same in any form of risk management is. Also, what we're beginning to see is emerging demand for what's called financed emissions. So as a financial institution, what's the percentage of emissions or that your dollars that are going out the door are responsible for? And what I'm pretty sure no one can read on the right-hand side of the screen is from our annual report, which was just released last week as well, which for the first time actually includes a metric on financed emissions for our lending into the energy generation sector. So for about 5 years, we've actually reported the breakdown by energy source of our lending into infrastructure and utilities. This year, we put an emissions intensity overlay on top of that. And what that showed was that the emissions intensity of our lending into the energy sector is roughly half the emissions intensity of the national electricity market in Australia. So what does that show you from an investor perspective? It shows you that we're not investing in the most carbon-intensive assets in the energy generation sector. So, I mean, this is the kind of financially linked information that investors are beginning to look for to understand how is your strategy translating into commercial outcomes, how are you communicating that to the market? As a bank, how well positioned are you for emerging carbon risk? So, I mean, I could have spent my 10 minutes talking about how we integrate carbon risk into credit systems and processes or training credit risk officers or all these sorts of issues. But what I thought I would do instead is actually try and sort of capture how you take a massive issue like climate change and translate it into strategy, commercial outcomes, have a view on it, disclosure to the market, and then perhaps leave to the panel discussion some of the more specific and granular issues. So I'll stop there and hand over to the next speaker, and happy to take any questions afterwards. Oh, and here's my disclaimer in case you believed anything I said.
Good. So, on to our third and final speaker, last but not least. Tim Andrews is an actuary and director at Findlay Consulting, specialises in general insurance. He has extensive experience in claim reserving, pricing and portfolio management, and is currently the appointed actuary for three insurers. He has a particular interest in this area. In addition to his valuation roles, Tim also leads Findlay's natural perils, climate change and commercial lines rate-making practice groups. Please welcome Tim.
Thanks, Brett. Look, in my 10 minutes, I'm going to be focused in a more limited way to start with on the impacts on property damage of climate change. And then I'm going to kind of morph into discussing the role that the insurers play in the kind of helping with the community manage this issue going forward. And then, and there's certainly some overlaps in that piece of it with what we've heard so far. If I start just with looking at the costs that to insurers of natural perils in recent years, I suppose this is a way of thinking how much is climate change impacting on property damage costs so far. In a way, I call this my you ain't seen nothing yet slide. The key slide here is this bottom one. This is when we adjust the catastrophe claims costs that have been experienced by private insurers for inflation, changes in building standards, and for the shifts in the population, we get something that looks like this. There, and look, there's some lumpiness in that, and we've got these periods here. These are dominated by La Nina years, so a bunch of wet years that we kind of understand the drivers of. We had 5 out of 6 La Ninas here, and this period between 92 and 2006 kind of dominated by El Ninos. I look at that chart and I say so far, really there's variability, but there's no clear upwards shift. That's not to say that the environment is not actually worse, but just so far the claims costs adjusted for the variability have not shown a significant upward kick. So you ain't seen nothing yet, which means, one, you ain't seen nothing yet because there's nothing to have been seen, but secondly, there's a clear implication that there's a lot to come, and that's what I'm going to talk about next. One thing when I'm looking at the impacts of the climate change, I think it's worth bearing in mind is it's not the same everywhere. So I just encourage you to consider that when you're thinking about climate change impacts. Now, if we're thinking rainfall, it's not going to get wetter everywhere. There's certainly parts of the world that are going to get much wetter. And as Barbara said, actually for much of Australia, we're going to get quite a bit drier. This chart on the left here is actually what's happened in the last 43 years, and the brown is the drying out, and you'll see Southern Australia in particular, where on both west and south, are having some real drying out problems. We've got, like, the scientists call it the three-headed dog that drives our climate, the patterns that drive our climate. We've got ENSO up here, that's the warm water in the Pacific Ocean. We've got the warm water in the Indian Ocean, that's the Indian Ocean dipole. And down the bottom, we've got the southern annular mode, which is basically the way where the westerly winds blow. Unfortunately, the Indian Ocean dipole is going to what it's called a positive phase. Southern annular mode is going to what is called a positive phase. And ENSO is becoming more El Nino-like. All of those bring drying out. And those effects are allowed for in the GCMs, in the global climate models. And they're why we're getting this kind of prediction of weather or rainfall for Australia going forward. And you'll see this continued drying out that we're getting across the country. The only part of the country where, on average, they're predicting more rainfall is in the north. They're also saying we're going to get more intense rainfall occurring. And when you look at the stats, there's not a lot of evidence of that so far, but that's what we're told that we should be expecting to see going forward, the increasing intensity. So in terms of my take on the future, and I won't dwell on this too much, but I think it's worth thinking about by peril. Barbara mentioned bushfire. There's no doubt so far the bushfire risk has increased. And we can see that in the Forest Fire Danger Index, that effectively measures the atmospheric conditions, and that has already been increasing. We can see that historically. We've also seen more cost, and we can kind of probably sense that risk has increased. And they're talking about that, you know, that the risk there could double or more beyond what we're at now in terms of bushfire impact. So that's going to be very significant. Cyclones, interestingly, so far, in recent years, cyclone trends have been, in recent years, across the last 40 years, pretty stable. So no clear shift in the number of cyclones happening. In the last 100 years, it's actually, for Australia, a lower number of cyclones that have been experienced over the long period. So we're actually in a quiet phase anyway. And it's a bit unclear about whether cyclones are going to be up or down. The warm water should mean more, but the vertical wind shear is going to interrupt that, and it basically disturbs the wind blowing in different speeds at different heights, disturbs the formation of them, and the reasons to expect we may not get as many. The shift southwards is important because bringing some of those cyclones down further impacts on more populated areas. So floods so far, I think there hasn't been a significant increase as a result of climate change from the floods, but with this increasing intensity of rain, there does seem to be the potential for that to occur, and certainly projections I've been involved with were assuming more flood cost. This one is the one I really worry about, storm surge, so actions of the sea. And again, Barbara was talking to that, and that's where we're going to get costs that are massive. I'll come back to that. Storms, so these are about, by the way, half of the natural peril costs that insurers pay. And I don't think we're seeing big reasons to expect the storm claims cost themselves to go up. There's a number of papers out that says the East Coast low is actually going to reduce in frequency, and they drive a lot of that storm cost. So these actions of the sea, this is stuff that Geoscience put out. You can kind of have a look at any or many parts of Australia and see how you fare. Basically, this is showing where water levels could be if we get the 1 metre of sea level rise when we get the kind of king tide in a particular area. And you'll see, we get lots of houses that are currently houses there, and just the king tide is going to flood those houses. When we combine that with storm surge, and storm surge is the water levels rising as a result of a storm, often associated with cyclones, but they can also be associated with the normal east coast lows, etc. And when we get that accompanied with this stuff, we have issues that are orders of magnitude greater than the current problems we've got with flood. And I think it's a particular issue that we're going to have going forward, making the insurance of these properties is going to be totally unaffordable. Not to say that this risk is necessarily insured anyway, and I'll touch on that now. Okay, so what are the insurers doing to kind of help us with this? Some stuff, which I'm pleased to say. So certainly one role that the insurance industry has is insuring the risk, so providing protection to people. It doesn't change the risk, except that it provides a price signal. So I'm going to come back and talk to that at the bottom, because I think that's really important to the changes that might come in future. So otherwise, there's protection provided to communities as a result of some of the impacts of climate change occurring. Look, I worry about this one. Firstly, I should say, flood, is that solved? No. I mean, there's plenty of people with high flood risk now that really can't get affordable insurance cover, and where there's still going to be flood claims arising, and those people aren't going to be insured. So, let's not pretend that flood is solved, and it's all about affordability. And actions of the sea, it's going to be the same thing. To a large extent, actions of the sea aren't insured now. So storm surge associated with cyclone is often insured, but to a large extent, coastal erosion and other actions of the sea aren't insured and aren't going to become insured. I think it's going to be a very difficult problem. So this insurance of natural peril risk is something insurers do to some extent, but only to a limited extent, I think, in some of the areas that will be impacted by climate change. The insurer's role in education is an important one. Emma talked about, there's various forms that Emma talked about the kind of involvement of Westpac, and they've done a range of things. They've also been involved with the Australian Business Roundtable on resilience and safer communities and other reports that group have put out, as have other insurers. There's things that individual insurers are doing with, for example, Suncorp are doing work at the moment with James Cook Uni, where they're looking at the resilience of individual houses to cyclone. And they've basically given them all their data on properties that were affected in Yarsi and saying, what can you analyse about the resilience of different properties? So there's things that both individual insurers are doing and the Insurance Council. The Insurance Council also done some work with James Cook Uni on looking at strata developments and how can we make them safer. So there's plenty of things the insurers are funding either individually or as part of the Insurance Council. We've also seen the insurers working with this connection with the levels of government, working with local government sometimes. Arome is an example that often gets cited whereby the insurers and the local council communicated. When Suncorp pulled out of the market there, the levy was built and Suncorp are now back in providing cover that is affordable. So the role of the insurers in this education piece is it's kind of research and education. I think insurers aren't doing too bad there. A key one, and Barbara touched on this, the kind of measurement of risk, so identifying which properties are exposed and making that information available. Insurers are doing a lot now, so and for those of you who don't know, we can now measure at the address level the flood risk, the bushfire risk, the storm surge risk, the cyclone risk, and the storm risk to a large extent. So, and insurers are doing that, so they're measuring those things at the individual address level. Insurers are looking at how many trees you've got on your block and how that's going to impact on your storm cost as an example of companies or of people that aren't aware of that. So that information is being used by insurers, and one of the challenges is to what extent can that information be made available to the community so that we can help understand, make informed decisions and therefore make the right decisions going forward. And I understand, Barbara, that's one of the keys to, and the Productivity Commissioner kind of promoting that. I think there are a few roadblocks in, not roadblocks, but hurdles to get over in getting there. And clearly they're around kind of IP issues, the kind of competitive advantage that those that have put some of those data sets together are looking to get. And some of the kind of consequences for individuals when they find out that their property might be in a higher risk area and the issues that flow from that in terms of property values, et cetera. So I think there's a few, I don't know if the hurdles or kind of speed bumps, but there's a bit to be done to kind of overcome some of those challenges around getting that data out there. So the last one I suppose I wanted to say something on was this price signal. I'll briefly also tell you, for those of you who don't know, there's this, the Building Resilience Rating Tool. That's something the Insurance Council has been working on. And that's about identifying for individual properties. It's kind of a series of 30 questions that helps you understand what the property's made from, how high is it off the ground, what's in the walls, what's the foundations, what's the roof type. And that information would enable the risk of that property to be assessed properly. It would be given a rating. So the idea from this is it gets a bit like an ANCAP rating or an electricity rating that a fridge might get, and you'd know your house is either 3, 4, or 5 star, and that would be used by the insurer in pricing. That's the kind of initiative the Insurance Council is working on now. I know there's a lot of people sceptical about whether that will get anywhere. I see it getting some momentum, especially with the productivity report coming out and the focus that's being put around data. So the price signals, it's one that worries me. Barbara talked about the need for actuaries to be considering the future cost of climate change. And one of the challenges here, because the Productivity Commission have also talked about the importance of price in providing a signal to ensure the right actions are taken. So this property is very high risk. Why and what can we do to mitigate it? I kind of like that approach. The problem, of course, when we're pricing insurance for property covers now, they're one-year covers, and the price that we're putting on them is a one-year insurance price. So I don't think it's necessarily going to deal of itself with the need to fix things. They're going to be a problem in 50 years' time but aren't a problem now. And so that's one of the, I think, the real challenges is if we can't rely on the price signal to create some of the incentives that are needed in the system to provide the funding to mitigate some of the actions that are needed. Now, I went through that quite quickly because I was hoping that would give us more time for questions. Yeah. Well done.
Thank you, Tim. 3 excellent presentations. We are behind schedule, but I would like to take some questions, so I invite the speakers up to the comfy chairs. As I said before, please text through your questions to the number on the screen, and we do have a microphone on the floor somewhere, I think, at the back, so we'll take questions from there as well. Okay, I might kick off with one for Barbara. The risks from climate change are escalating and will bring many new considerations. What, and I guess this sort of elaborates on some of the things you talked about, what should actuaries be considering building into their assumptions in the future?
Probably my whole talk, actually. Well, I think it's a bit like my profession in planning. We have based our decisions on a certain set of norms for a long time. And I think our profession, just like yours, I suspect, and the engineering profession and lots, are slowly coming to the realisation that it is not normal in the future and that we will, as I said, it's not business as usual, so that we are dealing with a much more dynamic environment in the future. And so it's, yes, we've had environmental risks before, but the quantum of risks change will be much more significant. So I think that's why scenario planning is so important in the future. We have to be able to think much more widely than we have before. Also, I think that a point that wasn't raised, but I should have mentioned before, is the impact of a coincidence of events. So there are a number of different impacts that were discussed just before, fire, flood. But if you take the example of the Brisbane floods, it was the combination of heavy downfall, and I think you mentioned this, heavy downfall on the one hand coming from inland, downstream, and a king tide coming from the ocean together. So everyone had modelled one or the other, but had not modelled the coincidence of events. So this is a much bigger risk than we anticipated and hadn't planned for. And so that's something I think that you should be modelling and starting to think about as well.
I think that's a common theme across a lot of risk management. You know, the example we heard before about the World Trade Center catastrophe and the coincidence of different risks that people hadn't considered.
Just very quickly, sure. Just to highlight, I guess, re-emphasise what was just said before around the Productivity Commission, that the don't expect the public policy decision-making processes to be responding quickly enough to some of the issues that you'll be dealing with. So I think we will be dealing with market failure in that sense. Certainly in this country right now, we'll be experiencing that, because it won't be until we actually get on the front foot on these issues that that regulatory environment will start to respond effectively, and you're part of that.
Just an extension of what you just mentioned. We just had a question up that, if I paraphrase, it said that planning was often focused on risks to life rather than to property damage. What do we need to do to address that? What do we need to change?
It's an interesting perspective, because quite often it's put to me the other way around, that we're there protecting assets and we forget about the people. So that's an interesting perspective. Well, clearly it's both. People do come first. It's our humans, and the communities that we are planning for and trying to minimise risk for. Assets, I think that governments have been focused, as I said, on some of the easier ones to deal with, but no one's really addressing the big ones, particularly around the coastal environment, defence, telecommunications, national security, ports, airports. Those are the big questions in the future. And you talk about superannuation industries. I think, Emma, you talked about superannuation. That's where their investments are. And so 50 years is nothing. If you're going to build a second airport in Sydney, for example, you would be needing to be thinking about these considerations right at the forefront, because we'll be here for 100 years to come.
Thank you. Emma, question for you. How would you rate the performance of your company against that of your peers? Or maybe if I was to rephrase that.
Is that a loaded question? Like, obviously, far, far in the lead.
A question from someone else from Westpac in the audience. Or maybe if I put it another way, what's the rest of the industry doing?
Yeah, from what you can observe. In all fairness, there is a fair amount of competition within the Australian financial services sector in particular. For some reason, property and financial services compete very heavily in sustainability and environmental credentials coming out of Australia. I'm not quite sure how it happened, but somehow it's become a dimension of intense competition between the banks in Australia. We also, and this is probably dangerous of me to say, but we also collaborate fairly strongly around agreeing the frameworks for competition. Or sometimes, as we prefer to say it, we collaborate to compete, in terms of the fact that we have pretty strong working groups and collaborative initiatives around understanding these sorts of cross-industry impacts, such as reporting frameworks, emerging issues, through forums such as the UN Environment Programme Finance Initiative, where we're all members as well. And also ensuring that we're comparing like for like when we're reporting, and then we're actually competing on outcomes and not competing on reporting frameworks or initiatives, that kind of thing. So there's actually pretty strong competition. I'd say that we're all slightly better in different ways, and we've all taken a slightly different approach dependent on our actual underlying business. But, yeah, this is definitely an area of strong interest. Interestingly enough, there was another question up there around the government response. I think you'll also find this is an area where, particularly in financial services, given that we have exposures across every industry sector and a pretty high profile, where you have to look at what companies are doing more than necessarily what they're prepared to come out and publicly say. Because I think in that sense you get a strong indication of the fact that the risk has been recognised and financial institutions are looking to put in place, particularly on credit assessment, a response on these sorts of issues.
Good. We've got a question at the front, if there's a roaming mic for Frank. Just while that's coming, we might take another one from the texts. Question for you maybe, Tim. Over there. Do you think the government and community are aware of the extent to which climate change impacts are not covered by insurance and bank policies, for example, coastal surge, erosion, LMI, etc.?
Mm. Yeah. There's a 2013 survey the Insurance Council did of when it was about under insurance at the time, and they were asking insureds about their policies. And it's quite an amazing read, and something like 45% of people don't know they're covered for earthquake, 25% don't think they're covered for storm. So I think to start with, we're starting with a view that, well, the community don't really know what they're covered for, certainly individuals. And I think we had an event like, you know, the floods in 2011 highlighted the fact that many people weren't insured for flood and led to some improvements that have made that position better, but it's not fixed. We are going to get a big storm surge event at some stage. You know, it could have been Yasi, but Yasi had a 5-metre storm surge, but it hit with low tide. And the storm surge effect was therefore minimal, and it could have been a 5-metre storm surge. And some insurers don't cover storm surge, and the same issue would have come out. So I wouldn't expect that many would be aware of the extent to which insurers are covering what I think is the key risk that's going to emerge from, besides bushfire, which I think is key, that the storm surge and coastal erosion effect is going to be key and is primarily not covered, and there's not awareness of it.
Can I just add quickly to that? In the UK report that I read that I placed up there, one of the points they made was that because the impacts from the coastal environment are largely not insured, then there's an underreporting of the financial impact of climate change generally, because that's not factored in, and so that's having some impact as well.
I would also just add that in the construction of new large pieces of infrastructure in coastal areas, I think that there is a reasonable level of awareness around these sorts of issues. The level of response is variable because there is no mandated requirement per se. But I think, you know, companies, when they're looking at large fixed assets in high-risk zones, are identifying the risks. My concern is how much they are required to and how much money they're investing in the response to the risk. But in the residential space and at the community level, I think there's a fairly low level of understanding around the financial implications of adaptation.
Very good. Frank's been very patient down the front there. Do you have a question? A comment?
Yeah, just a comment I'd like to and Emma touched on that's what groups are doing with that in terms of taking forward what is whereas given what we look at But that's the very thing that actually is going to get done about. And I want to do this. Everybody in the nation has said, hang on, we've got to do something. Would we actually? And I don't think boards, CEOs, have not been good.
I think that's a pretty multi-part question. I can make a couple of observations on that. I think first is that that what you're seeing is an increasing trend of investor-driven desires and requests for disclosure from boards and from executive teams of companies around how they're managing the commercial implications of these issues for their business. And you're seeing that at AGM.
They're reacting
or the fact that they're prepared to talk about it in the context of business performance, it's an open question. It's an open question as to whether or not it's always the most constructive contribution to the debate to engage in the political debate on these particular issues, or rather to talk about it in the context of your core area of expertise. Like, as a financial institution, what is our role in the public policy discussion? It's to talk about it in the context of the areas where we have an influence and have an impact and how we're responding. It's not necessarily, arguably, our role to wade into every daily news cycle around the political aspects of it. And in the context of talking about it from an investor perspective or from the board and the executive team perspective, we do that. And we do it in our annual report, we do it in our strategies, we do it in our AGM, and we've been doing it for years. So in that context, I think it's fair to say that financial institutions are talking about the issues. But the question of the political response and how that's reported and how that's discussed, I mean, that's almost indicative of the complex and devilish nature of the problem, that I don't think it's surprising that you're going to have such a volatile political discussion around these issues. They are pretty fundamental, and I think Australia, you know, regardless of your position on the appropriate political response, there's no doubt that in the last 5 years in particular, we've come a huge way in terms of the sophistication of the levels of debate. You might not agree with the outcomes, but there's no doubt that engagement from the business sector and discussion of the issues is definitely coming through in the core business channels, through AGMs, through annual reports, through scenario modelling, through those sorts of channels. So the two-part answer to your four-part question, I think.
Just for the other speakers, there's a couple of questions that sort of touch on this. So if you can maybe work those into your responses, and particularly the one about the profession is probably more relevant for you, Tim, but... The question is, to paraphrase, should the profession be doing more to speak out about the impacts of climate change, and how is it possible to achieve anything meaningful about climate change given the massive resistance at the highest levels of government?
I might just quickly respond to the industry question.
Sure.
I think that, there's two quick answers. One, we're certainly seeing change in terms of discussion and advice being sought at the corporate body, the corporate board level. You won't see it on the front page of The Australian, but trust me, those who are investing in the long term on the Northwest Shelf are factoring in climate change. So this is occurring. And we're on the other side of the nation, up in the Great Barrier Reef, we've seen two global banks withdraw from investing in port development only in the last month there. So that's through a lot. Well, I suspect it's more complicated. It's partly through community pressure, but... Also, I think people are starting to look more seriously at the future of coal in the long term. In terms of being a political issue, that's something particular to Australia, Canada and the US. The rest of the world's kind of moved on. And it's a bit like, how long do we want to stay in this space, or do we want to join China and Obama, I guess, who's brought the US back into the fold most recently. So that's something we just kind of have to get over at some point, and I hope it's sooner rather than later. In terms of the future, I don't think there's any question. And you spoke about opportunities in terms of green infrastructure, renewable energy, participating in carbon trading internationally. Leading business will want to be engaged in this space. So I just think it's going to happen very quickly, this change, very quickly. And we may not have seen a lot at the moment, but I think we'll see it happen quite rapidly, and so don't be surprised. and because they're not going to be locked out of those markets just because of who's running this country right now, despite the Business Council of Australia.
Tim?
Do you mind better if I talk to the question about should the profession be speaking
Absolutely.
Out?
Absolutely.
Yeah, look, I'm a, I enjoyed the what's it called, the blog that was on that earlier in the year, and I didn't participate in it, but I certainly had a look at it a few times. And I'm a strong supporter of the fact that I think we should be getting our views known in terms of the impacts that we have expertise around, and that would be what are the impacts to issues like affordability and insurance prices and longevity. So I think places where the actuaries have a role to play are where we can build our expertise to what some of the impacts that have been identified by others and quantify them, and that by that way help the community manage that risk.
I think it's also worth adding that, you mentioned the Australian Business Leaders Roundtable on Resilience that occurred that had a combination of insurance and banks involved, and the Red Cross, I think, as well, and which was looking at increasing community resilience to extreme weather events and these sorts of issues. And it did have an extremely constructive engagement with the government, and all of the recommendations from the report were picked up and are being translated into a government response. So policy and politics are not necessarily always the same thing. An effective response can happen through a number of different channels, and I guess chipping away at it and being constructive, providing useful information, using industry expertise and feeding it into the policy discussion is an incredibly vital role for the industry to play.
I agree with that, and I think more conversations between professions, your profession, Engineering Australia, Planning Institute, the Built Environment, Green Buildings Council, can only help find solutions.
Very good.
Yep.
I might draw a line under that because we are significantly over time. Like the federal government, we inherited a deficit and we haven't done much to eat into that yet. And we are disbanding after this, so that's our effort done. Thank you, our speakers. Could you please join me in thanking...